And warm, today's high 79, inland cooler near Lake Michigan. The numbers right now, a little breeze from the southeast at 8, 63 degrees across the board for Kenosha, Racine, Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva under a sunny sky. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's always exciting to be able to explore a chapter of American history that is largely unknown, largely forgotten. And there is something particularly haunting about the story that we are going to be exploring for the next few minutes. I'm going to be speaking with the author of a new book called Under the Iron Heel, The Wobblies and the Capitalist War on Radical Workers. This is the story of a very powerful union, the Industrial Workers of the World, or IWW, founded in 1905, a union unlike really any other that had existed in the United States up to that point. And they were really interested in trying to change the experience of industrial workers in drastic, revolutionary fashion. And what they had in mind was so feared by those who kind of held the reins of the capitalist industrial complex here in the United States that this union was beaten back in really savage fashion. To the point that it utterly disintegrated, went out of existence. And sadly, the story of this union and what it stood for has been largely forgotten. That is, until the writing of this new book. And the man responsible for it is Ahmed White, who teaches labor and criminal law at the University of Colorado Boulder. Also the author of The Last Great Strike, Little Steel, The CIO, and the Struggle for Labor Rights in New Deal America. This book, of course, is taking a look at events that happened just a little bit earlier than that. In the early part of the 20th century, when America was growing by leaps and bounds, but growing in some ways that also made life utterly miserable for literally millions of Americans. And the story of this union and what it wanted to accomplish is an amazing, inspiring story, well worth exploring. This book is published by the University of California Press, again titled Under the Iron Heel, The Wobblies and the Capitalist War on Radical Workers. Ahmed White, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Ahead of us talking about your book, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what drew you in the first place to this particular facet of our country's history and why you wanted to devote so much of your time and energy to its exploration. I don't mean this specific story, but just the whole story of labor and unions in general.
Yeah, that's something I guess, been interested in. Not all my life, certainly most of my adult life. It's a topic that I think brings to light more than any other the questions of class, of power and authority and alienation in a capitalist society, in any kind of society, but particularly in a capitalist society. So I've always had an interest in writing about labor on researching the topic. My interest in the IWW, I think, has a lot to do with an interest in agricultural labor. I think that's where initially my concern for the IWW originated. I grew up on a farm. I grew up among farm workers. I've done that work on and off all of my life, and that's what brought me to the IWW story some 22 years ago.
I think to understand the emergence of this group and the need for it, it's really important for us to understand, and I think your book does a great job of setting the stage, helping us to understand the really radical ways in which life was changed by what we think of as kind of the latter part of the Industrial Revolution, and what life was like for so many Americans in the late 19th and into the early 20th century. Describe this part of our history and again, what life was like for so many workers well ahead of the emergence of groups like the IWW.
Yes, you highlight something extremely important, essential in understanding the evolution of the IWW, and that's to do with the extraordinary ways that the rise of industrial capitalism transformed American life and the conditions under which millions of people lived and worked in this country. It was extraordinarily unsettling. It changed the old ways that people lived, and it did so in a way that overall increased the wealth in our society quite dramatically, but did so in a terribly uneven way and at the expense of extraordinary exploitation and frankly, deprivation and dangers. So one of the themes that emerges in this book is to do not only with the exploitation of these workers who ended up comprising the IWW, but the remarkable dangers they faced, the extraordinary insecurity of everyday life that the people who formed this organization endured, that was their lot in life, and that I think had a lot to do with not only their interest in forming unions like the IWW, but the very strong currents of revolutionary politics and revolutionary ambitions that typified the IWW and many other groups in the early 20th century.
One of the things you write, I think, gets me thinking about this in a way I hadn't before. You write, the economy surged in size, becoming by the early 20th century the largest in the world, amid tremendous changes in technology, production, and daily life. But nothing about industrial capitalism implied a revolution in fairness or humanity in the world of work, as this new order was captive to the logic of unending accumulation of capital, the principles of ruthless competition, and the dictates of efficiency, maximum return on investment, and profits. I really think that's interesting, because I think perhaps what happened with anybody who took the time to even think about such matters is maybe a naive assumption or overly optimistic assumption was made that as this revolution is sweeping over the world in terms of how we can make things and how fast we can make things, that somehow that was just going to lead to this general sweep of betterment for all people. And the closer you look at it, the more you realize that doesn't make sense at all. I mean, or one does not inevitably lead to the other, not at all. And what you are describing is a scenario in which, in a sense, the opposite occurred.
That's right. And, you know, part of the story here is a story about the unevenness and the contradictions of progress. In many, many ways, this period in American life was one of progress, of changes in ways that most people today think positively about. But as is always the case, the story of progress is a complicated one, and embedded in these changes were some really terrible things that people in the working class in this country paid for, and paid for much more so than anyone else. And the men and women who formed the IWW paid an even higher price than most workers did, than most other workers did.
One point that you make in this particular chapter, which is titled Socialism with Its Working Clothes On, you write that, as the IWW put it, industrial capitalism created a class of ownerless slaves consigned to lives of deprivation and insecurity. And you go on to write in this provocative paragraph that there are some ways, not in every way, but there are some ways in which this was even a worse situation than the situation that was experienced at least by some slaves, where at least there was an understanding of trying to safeguard the well-being of others, in at least in some basic ways, that was absent in this scenario that you are describing here. Tell us a little more about these kind of workers and their relationship with out-and-out slaves of some decades earlier.
Sure, and as you know, there's no way in which it was better to be in general a chattel slave than to be a wage worker in general, that is. But there were some particular ways in which the lot of industrial workers was terrible and kind of qualitatively different than what people experienced in chattel slavery, and that's mainly to do with the insecurity of their situation. What industrial capitalism did was take workers, not just chattel slaves, but people who had been peasants, even serfs in other parts of the world, and lived under conditions where there was culturally, sometimes legally, some obligation of the people they worked for to take care of them. And put them in a world in which no one was responsible for that but the worker himself and his immediate family. That was the root of the insecurity that these people endured. And this was particularly true of the people who formed the real core of the IWW during its period of greatest prominence in the late 19th, early 20th century, because these were migratory workers, overwhelmingly men who roamed the land doing one insecure temporary job after another. Many of them, most of them, had no fixed abode, no permanent home. And it's partly for that reason that they were attracted to the IWW, which for a lot of these people became their family, became their source of support in a world where, again, there were not a lot of alternative sources of that. And the old ways of giving people kind of solidity or security in life had largely evaporated.
We're going to talk in a moment about the drastic difference between these workers and the owners, so to speak, which you call at one point an association between alien and profoundly unequal parties. And, of course, that is so much at the heart of this. But I want to take a moment to have you talk about something else you discuss in this chapter. And that is this. You write, just as important to this story and the grievances that many workers harbored is the inequality that reigned within the working class. That is, that the unbearable, brutal hardships that we are talking about were not borne equally by all in the working class. What are the distinctions that are most significant? And what were the consequences of that kind of inequality even within the working class itself?
Yeah, so this was a period of great stratification among workers. And the main basis of that, the main determinant of that inequality, was skill, was whether a worker possessed a set of skills, a suite of skills that were essential in industrial production. And this dynamic was at the time being exacerbated, heightened by steady automation, mechanization of production, which on the one hand took a lot of skilled workers, a lot of people who used to do skilled work, and made their work, their skills, irrelevant, threw them out into the world as unskilled workers, made their skills irrelevant, at the same time that it created a growing labor market for people with the skills needed to run these new automated or mechanized machines. And so you had this stratification of workers, principally on the basis of skill, but it also mapped out along lines of race and ethnicity, where Northern Europeans, old stock Americans, as they were sometimes called, tended to dominate the higher skilled jobs in industrial America, and in the lower ranks were newer immigrants, especially from Southern Eastern Europe, Latinos, black workers, tended to be concentrated in the low-skilled, low-paying jobs. And then what also exacerbated that or highlighted these dynamics was the way the labor movement was organized then. There were some exceptions to this rule, but for the most part, most of the effective labor organizations in this country in the late 19th, early 20th century were craft unions organized along the lines of craft, of skill, and that were composed of only skilled workers. There were only a few so-called industrial unions that organized workers on the basis of industry without regard for skill, and that meant that unskilled workers tended to go without union representation, and that was one reason the IWW was formed, to give those workers effective union representation, that is to say, to organize the industrial working class on an industrial basis without regard for skill, and also without regard for ethnicity, for race, for sex or gender.
Essentially, anybody could belong to this new organization that your book focuses on.
That's right. Anybody, as long as he or she was a worker.
Right. By the way, just for a point of clarification, you just now were talking about craft unions. Your book also uses, from time to time, an even more commonly used term, which is trade union. Are those essentially the same?
Sometimes used in synonymous ways. The way I use it, the term trade union, is to contrast it to the IWW. Not only its industrial organization, but also its revolutionary purposes. It wasn't just about improving workers' conditions on the job. It was also, as you said at the outset of our conversation, explicitly about changing the world. And that distinguished it from most labor organizations at that time. A few paid lip service to the idea of revolutionary change, but only a very few took that notion seriously.
Right. And it sounds like craft unions and trade unions tended to be much more specific, much, in a sense, more limited in their focus versus the sweeping ideals and ambitions of the IWW, which we'll talk about in just a moment. I want to circle back to one more thing in terms of trying to understand this world in which the IWW sprang into being in 1905. And I was so glad you took the time to write this. This comes after you have described all of the ways in which work was crushing. You write about workers toiling in conditions that were frequently sweltering or frigid, dusty, dank, or noisy, monotonous and frenetic, tedious and backbreaking. I mean, extreme upon extreme upon extreme. Workers experienced all of this, including also frequent injury and frequent death. But then you go on to say this, which also spoke to me so powerfully. You write, life outside of work offered few compensations for those who endured these conditions. Poverty consigned millions of workers to live in squalid urban slums, shanty towns, and rural camps and hovels, where they were plagued by violent crime and delinquency, alcoholism and drug abuse, and the frequent disintegration of family under the strains of daily existence. Hunger, malnutrition, and premature death from illness, injury, and malaise were commonplace. Leisure was an extravagance, no less than learning, in a world that made prodigal luxuries of proper schooling and the serious pursuit of art, music, and literature. In other words, for the vast majority of the millions of workers for whom this was their reality, their lives included not a glimmer of those kind of pleasures like learning and the arts and so on that so easily can be utterly taken for granted. It's just hard to imagine human beings being able to endure that.
Yeah, and in fact, this was one of the main preoccupations of the IWW. One of the most impressive things about this organization was its determination to remedy that, and not only by changing the terms of exploitation, making work less preoccupying of workers' time and less exploitative, but also creating a structure within the union itself for workers to improve themselves, to enlighten themselves, to embrace their better beings. And so it was for that reason that IWW halls all over the country in the early 20th century were stocked with books, with literature and books on science and history and whatnot, musical instruments. They hosted lectures and speeches of various kinds. This was a major concern of the union and a very impressive one. The IWW's idea was that workers were not only industrial workers were not only no less than the middle classes. They were actually, in a world historical sense, superior. They would lead the world into what the IWW envisioned as would be a workers' commonwealth, and they needed to be prepared to do that. And one way to do that was to overcome the ways in which capitalism denied workers a proper education, a proper acculturation, and they would overcome that. They would help workers overcome that. That was, again, one of the major purposes of the organization itself. And it's, to me, again, very impressive.
We're speaking with Ahmed White, the author of Under the Iron Heel, The Wobblies and the Capitalist War on Radical Workers. The book tells the story of the formation of the Industrial Workers of the World, a group which was founded in 1905 for the express purpose of trying to remedy the kind of conditions that we have just been describing. Professor White, I think we should explain a couple of things that I probably should have asked you about at the outset. First of all, in the subtitle is this strange word, wobblies, and it's important for our listeners to understand what that term refers to.
Yeah, it's an interesting term. Even today, its origins are not clear. It's no one knows, I think, with any great confidence where it comes from. There are some older theories that are, I think, in less favor today, and they're not particularly appealing. They're problematic. I guess traditionally it was thought that this term originated from the inability of some immigrant workers to pronounce IWW properly. But I don't think there's a lot of support for that notion nowadays, and no one really knows where the term wobbly comes from. But the one thing that is clear is that back then everyone referred to the IWW or members of the IWW as wobblies, whether they were in the union or not, whether they liked the union or not. It's an interesting phenomenon that they came to be called this, and we don't really know for sure, at least, where the term comes from.
Right. You know, it's interesting, as you know, when I first saw that, It seemed like it might be the name of a funny children's toy or something. I mean, there's something. It is, you know, one imagines it being a term of derision that somebody coined, and certainly there's nothing funny about the story of the IWW or the kind of conditions that it made it necessary for such a group to be formed. I also want to ask you to explain to our listeners the main title, Under the Iron Heel, which comes from a very famous work, maybe not so famous anymore, from a very gifted writer who you call a great champion of this group, one Jack London. Tell us about
Yes.
Under the Iron Heel.
Yes, so the title of my book is taken directly from Jack London's dystopian novel written just a couple years after the IWW was formed, called The Iron Heel, which is roughly patterned on what he saw and what he imagined would be the experience of the IWW. It tells the story of a initially successful workers' uprising led by a figure not unlike the leader of the IWW, William Big Bill Hayward, where that in the book that uprising is viciously crushed, and it leads to centuries of domination of the working class. And it's a parable for London and for his audience about the attractions of the appeals of the importance of worker radicalism, but also the threats to such a movement, and the threats posed not only by the capitalists, the oligarchy, as he called it, but also their collaborators among the working class. The book was very popular in its day. It was very influential because it kind of functions not only as literature, but also as an introduction to socialist thought and socialist theory. And so it was very important for the IWW at the same time that London drew on the IWW's experience and his thoughts about what happened to the Union in developing the plot for the book. So as I wrote the book, at some point I decided not only that it would be important to include this connection between London and the IWW in the story, but at some point I decided I just could not I could not resist titling the book after the Jack London book.
It's a perfect title. It really, really is. So take us to late June 1905 and to the corner of Clark and Erie Streets in downtown Chicago, and to this event that someone called the Continental Congress of the Working Class, the event at which this new group was formed. And I guess if you're going to take us to this momentous day, you need to also tell us something about Big Bill Hayward, whom you just mentioned, who was really one of the chief figures in creating this group.
Yes, he was the one who pronounced this founding convention that you allude to in Chicago in summer of 05 as the Continental Congress of the Working Class. He very famously pounded a 2x4 on the podium when he called this convention to order. It was very interesting. It was attended by about 200 delegates who ran the gamut of labor and left activists in that period. There were some conventional unionists there who were, I think, somewhat distantly interested in the proceedings, but the core of the convention consisted of socialist, anarchist, and militant industrial unionists. Who were all intent on forming an organization that would effectively organize the industrial working class, and that in some sense or another would challenge the reign of capitalism in America. So again, they were different in their revolutionary ideology and aspirations, socialist, anarchist, and whatnot. But there was a strong element, a dominant element of anti-capitalism among the people who formed the union that summer. And Big Bill was the leading figure there, and he went on to be the leading figure in the IWW in the next 15 years or so, including during the period that the book focuses on, when the union was subjected to the most intense repression in the late 19-teens and to the early 1920s. It was Big Bill, as he was almost universally called, who was at the helm of the organization.
You quote for us a line from the preamble of the constitution of this new organization, this pronouncement that, in their words, the working class and the employing class have nothing in common, and then boldly declared a state of class war. You know, it's interesting to read those words and perhaps take issue with them, but I have a feeling that in 1905, those words actually probably were actually very true. That is, there was such a gulf, such a divide between the typical worker and those who employed them, that probably that statement is not only true, but maybe not, doesn't go far enough in describing the scenario.
Yeah, and it was not near, as you suggest, not nearly as controversial among at least many workers then as it would be today. And one reason for that was what we talked about earlier, the savage exploitation that occurred in industrial America. But another reason, which bears mention, is the violence that pervaded the relations between workers and capitalists during this period. And that was not entirely, but largely in one direction. Hundreds of workers were killed in clashes with employers and employers' agents during this period. And untold thousands were critically injured in these affrays. And so this hatred that many workers had for the capitalist class was rooted in that as well. Many of these people had witnessed or knew people who had been struck down on picket lines and other struggles between workers and militiamen or the private police forces that many employers maintained. And so it would not be hard for them to give vent to this kind of visceral dislike for the capitalists. And you combine that with something else we alluded to earlier, the really extraordinary inequality in wealth, the fact that workers and capitalists in many ways lived in two very different worlds, like that John Dos Passos said this in very famously in his USA trilogy, all right, we're two nations then. Well, we were two nations then. And many people in one of those nations, many workers, despised the capitalist who lorded over them.
Hmm. I want to get some clarification from you on one thing. As you were describing this new organization, you know, first of all, you spell out they were proposing to organize the entire working class, regardless of industry or skill. Unlike most unions and the great majority of civic organizations in the country, they opened the union's membership to everyone without regard for sex, race, age, or nativity. All workers would be welcomed into an organization dedicated to overthrowing capitalism and abolishing wage labor. I want to ask you about that last part. If wage labor were to be abolished, what did they imagine as taking its place? I mean, what kind of labor would remain, or what kind of work would be done by whom and under what circumstances? What was
that
the new...
is a good question, and a question of the sort that many leftist revolutionary organizations never got around to answering with a lot of clarity. And the IWW is one such organization. It also never developed, I think, a clear vision of what that new society would look like. It was, in a lot of ways, a syndicalist organization, meaning that to the extent it had a clear vision here, that vision was one rooted in the idea that society would be organized by workers themselves and that the workplace would be the central focus of social organization, as opposed to, say, for Bolsheviks or many socialists of various stripes, the state. They were skeptical of and generally hostile to the idea of a social organization premised on the state. But beyond that, again, they were not so clear about that. Maybe they were just, you know, possessed of a sort of utopian optimism. Who knows? They simply did not have a clear and well-fashioned view of how things would work. They had a vision, but not a plan.
How was it that they went about gathering potential workers, particularly when it came to that first meeting in 1905, but then shortly thereafter? What were the means available to them to, in a sense, spread the word and garner more members?
So they did some interesting things for a while, especially in the first decade of the union's existence. One thing it proved pretty good at was taking hold of labor disputes that arose more or less without the union's direct participation. And so this was the nature of the union's involvement in some of its most celebrated strikes. In 1912, the so-called Bread and Roses strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts, among textile workers, a huge event in American life. And that was followed by an almost as prominent labor dispute a year later in Paterson, New Jersey, also among textile workers. And again, in both cases and many, many other cases in this period, the union would kind of take hold of a dispute that was already underway. And it did a pretty good job of that. The problem was it seldom was able to maintain support among those workers after the strike ended. So it'd sign up a whole bunch of members, but in a year or so, most of those people had drifted away. Another thing the union did early in its history, and into the 19-teens and 20s in some cases, that is much celebrated, and with good reason, was to spread its message by so-called free speech fights. What these basically involved, and most of them were in the western part of the country, what it basically involved was union people conducting speeches in public spaces, typically in small towns, but some bigger cities, in defiance of local ordinances or policies that didn't permit them to do this. And so inevitably, they'd get arrested. Someone would get arrested. Another person would get arrested. This would escalate. And the union would respond by bringing in dozens, sometimes hundreds and hundreds of workers who were prepared also to be arrested for defying these restrictions on speech. And the idea would be to overwhelm the local authorities' ability to put them all in jail, and to force them to relent and grant them the right to speak. So one thing this did was expand the right to speech and to speak in this country, and in so doing to sort of burnish the credentials of this organization in the eyes of workers and gather and gain attention and publicity for it. Another thing it did, kind of what underlay this practice, was to serve as a way of reaching out to migratory workers who had no fixed homes that you could reach, where you could reach them, and they had to be reached in public spaces. And so the union did this in a very celebrated way, at great expense in terms of the number of workers who were jailed and beaten and all of that. It didn't lend itself to the recruitment of a vast number of members, though, And so it wasn't until the mid-19-teens that it finally settled upon a tactic that worked, that got it a growing base of members who remained with the organization. And what that involved, in brief, was a method of the union called a job delegate system of inserting organizers among the workers it was trying to organize. Organizers who followed these workers around, who worked alongside of them, and who signed up members in that way. This was extremely effective, especially among migratory workers in industries like agriculture, timber, construction, oil, on the waterfront, in mining. And it was in this way that the union built its membership in the late teens into something that was truly threatening.
One of the points of concern and one of the means by which this new group could be attacked by capitalist forces, shall we say, was the whole business of sabotage, which they were accused of engaging in, and which to some extent they did. Although one of the things you say in your book is that this group, in a sense, talked about sabotage more often than they actually engaged in it. And perhaps we also need to be careful about the way in which the term is being used here. What was the means of by which sabotage was part of what the IWW did?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Sabotage was central to the repression of the union. It was the leading means, along with the related notion that the organization was undermining the war effort, of justifying anti-IWW repression. And it was premised on the union's fascination with the term, something that began around 1910 when IWW speakers and writers began with great frequency to celebrate sabotage as a means of opposing the employer's power in the workplace. So some people are familiar with the black cat symbol of the IWW. It's still around today. Well, that reflected or represented this concept of sabotage. It's not clear how much actual sabotage the union engaged in, the union's members engaged in, except to say it really wasn't all that common, and it never was expressly sanctioned by the organization itself. Usually when IWW speakers talked about sabotage, it was in a way that at least could be equated to something different than the term as we typically understand it today. So nowadays, sabotage means breaking the machinery, you know, actual acts of destruction. Back then, it had a parallel meaning, which aligned with the IWW's philosophy of opposing the employers at the point of production with tactics like slowdown strikes and quickie strikes and kind of inefficient adherence to the supposed rules of the workplace, things like that. As often as not, when members of the union invoke the concept of sabotage, that's what they had in mind. The problem is, after some years of this celebration of sabotage in the union speeches and publications, it became indelibly associated with the term, and the term was, in the minds of many people, associated with destruction. And the union's members engaged in just enough destructive sabotage to give credibility to the charge that it was a dangerous organization that was bent on destruction.
The balance of your book focuses on the way in which this group was systematically attacked. And one of the means by that was by the establishment all across the country of laws involving syndicalism. This was a brand new term to me. Briefly describe what this means was and how effective it was.
Yes, these were laws, most of them felony laws, most enacted west of the Mississippi, where the IWW was especially active. that were devised to make it a crime to be a member of the IWW. And they did it in a pretty clever way. They didn't just come out and say, if you're in the union, you're a criminal. That would have been unconstitutional. Instead, what they did was to make it a crime to advocate revolutionary change by means of violence, sabotage, or other criminal acts, and also to make it a crime simply to be a member of an organization that advocated that kind of revolutionary change. The purpose was to make being a member of the IWW a crime, and this sufficed to do that, because all that prosecutors and police had to do was convince jurors that the IWW itself was committed to this kind of revolutionary change by means of crime and sabotage and whatnot, and count on the fact that even if they could disclaim their membership in the union, most IWWs, most Wobblies, given their ethos, given their politics, were not about to deny their membership in the organization. They didn't. And so hundreds of Wobblies were convicted and hundreds sent to prison in these western states on the basis of prosecution under these criminal syndicalism laws.
And you certainly describe plenty of instances in which, beyond being imprisoned, they often were subjected to truly brutal treatment, which we can read more about in your book. Briefly, can you also touch on the fact that the disintegration of the IWW is not only the result of these attacks from outside, I mean, and those are the primary cause, of course, but there was also internal dissension that also ultimately undermined this organization. Can you just briefly describe what this internal conflict or division was?
Yeah, in the simplest sense, it had to do with how much of a conventional union the IWW would be alongside of existing as a revolutionary organization. Most all of the union's members were committed to its revolutionary purposes. But the question was, in what balance to its function as a conventional union? And this was exacerbated by some kind of parallel disputes about communism. The IWW never did embrace communism, which was a fundamentally different ideology than what the union had on offer, but there still were questions about how the organization would relate to the communist movement as it evolved in the late 19-teens, early 1920s. And so this created a schism within the union that by the mid-1920s converged with repression to seal the organization's fate, to essentially destroy it. Mm.
In our last minute or so, are there lessons we can learn from the IWW or elements of its mission that are applicable to modern-day America and the modern-day world?
There certainly are. I think if nothing else, this organization's history is an inspiring one. If you want to learn something about courage in the face of repression, there's no better place to look than in the history of the IWW. What its members endured and how they endured it, the grace and courage with which they faced their repression is unsurpassed, I would say, in American history. And I think related to that, the union story is a cautionary story about the state, about the relationship between organized labor and particularly radical elements in organized labor and liberal or progressive reformers, and how tenuous that relationship can be. And so it's a cautionary story as well about trusting the state and the importance of being skeptical about the authority of the state when you're advancing a revolutionary aim.
The book again is Under the Iron Heel, The Wobblies and the Capitalist War on Radical Workers, published by University of California Press, and the author, Ahmed White. Professor White, this is one of those largely forgotten stories that does not deserve to be forgotten. It should not be lost to oblivion, and I'm so glad you have written this book in order to tell this story so well. Thank you for writing the book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today.
Oh, thank you. I'm very happy to have been here this morning. Much appreciated.